Morning, Holden.
Morning.
Good morning. Welcome back to some of you who were under the weather yesterday. Nice to see you today. Glad to know that you all are still among the living. Let's take a moment. Honor the God who made us with a moment of silence and gratitude. Breathe deeply. When you breathe in, take a moment to just, in your mind, say thanks. Breathe out, breathe in again, say thanks. Just take a minute. And now, lively God, you know the words, you can join me. Take our minds and think through them. Take our hands and work through them. Take our hearts and set them on fire. Amen. Day three of this boring deeper into this notion of multiplicity, we're going to be talking a little bit about, we're going to take a deep dive. We're going to go down to think about not just what does it mean to have parts, but what do parts or cells do with one another, and what can they do in making us richer, fuller, more abundant servants of God? What does it take to make us more, to give us more capacity, to give us more resource, and to give us more abundance? We're going to take our multiplicity, we're going to take it down a little deeper. Tomorrow we're going to take it out big, because we're going to be talking about the multiplicity of God. So I always like to start with people, because once you experience it yourself, then it's not so hard to think about how is God much. Some of my students call this the muchness of God. So tomorrow we're going to talk about the muchness of God. Today we're going to talk about the muchness of you, okay? There's a psalm, many psalms. Yesterday afternoon, all afternoon, I just sat and read psalms. And the voices, the multiple voices that come through that poetry, that come through the psalmist's prayers, if you need to understand or hear or get an ear for human multiplicity, read the psalms. Everything's in there. This one is one of my favorites. I'm realizing that you might be getting tired of hearing my voice. Are there readers out here who would like to read maybe paragraph by paragraph? Do we have readers? Oh, please. One, read the first paragraph, second paragraph. Do we have a third paragraph to bring it home? Thank you. You're going to have to, as my singing teacher used to say, from your gut.
Psalm 139. O Lord, you have searched me and known me. You know when I sit down and when I rise up. You discern my thoughts from far away. You search out my paths and my lying down and are acquainted with all my ways. Even before a word is on my tongue, O Lord, you know it completely. You hem me in before and behind and lay your hand on me. Such knowledge is too wonderful for me. It's so high I cannot attain it. Where can I go from your spirit? Or whence can I flee from your presence? If I ascend into heaven, you are there. If I make my bed in Sheol, you are there.
If I take the wings of the morning and settle at the farthest limits of the sea, even there your hand shall lead me, and your right hand shall hold me fast. If I say, surely the darkness shall cover me, and the light around me become night, even the darkness is not dark to you. The night is as bright as the day, for darkness is as light to you.
For it was you who formed my inner parts, who knit me together in my mother's womb. I praise you, for I am fearful and wonderfully made. Wonderful are your works that I know very well. My frame was not hidden from you when I was being made in secret, intricately woven in the depths of the earth. Your eyes behold my unformed substance. In your book were written all the days that were formed in me, when none of them has yet existed. How weighty are your thoughts, O God? How vast is the sum of them? I try to count them. They are more than the sand. I come to the end. I am still with you.
the multiplicity of different voices speaking these words, and how much richer, how much more the words open to you as different voices voice them. So much could be said about voice and the way voice opens up this sense of multiplicity for us. So thank you, three readers, for reading for us this morning. What feeling did you have as you were listening to this psalm, as you were reading along? What were some of the feelings or images that came to your mind?
You still know that I am God. You still know that I am God. You still know that I am God.
Thank you. Thank you. So that kind of heldness, yes? There's a containment, there's a heldness in the images in this song. What else? What else did you feel in this?
I got one up here.
Yeah, oh, thank you. Nakedness. I'm gonna remind me to keep like looking up, look up, look up.
Nakedness.
Ah, say more about that.
Well, every little bit of me.
Yep.
What did she say?
Yeah, she said nakedness. The image that came to her mind was nakedness, because this is a psalm of exposure, right? Every little bit of you, that was a great way to say that, every little bit of us is open to the eyes of God. There's nowhere I can go. There's nothing you don't know. Very good, very good. There's a real vulnerability in this psalm.
And comfort.
Comfort.
Lots of comfort. I see myself hiding, and no matter what, God is finding me to lead me and hold me. I love the hold me fast.
Right, right. Very good, very good. What else? Comfort, vulnerability, yes.
Express in just one word, God is omnipresent.
Omnipresence, yes, absolutely. Everywhere. That omni word is helpful in this kind of conversation. God is everywhere. And there's a lot of everywheres in this text, right? Mm-hmm. There's a lot of imagery. The furthest limits of the sea, the wings of the morning, the light around me becoming night, and the darkness isn't dark to you. There's in my mother's womb, there's in the earth, there's a lot of imagery in the psalm. That's not by mistake. The psalmist could have said, you know what? You're everywhere. Thanks. Yeah. Right? Why not? Why didn't the psalmist do that?
That's not the way poetry is.
Why not? You're right, Wellesley. That's not the way poetry is. Why not? That's what I want you to think about. See, this is when my students get itchy, because I'm saying, why? Why not? Yeah. Right, because it connects with your heart, because there is so much particularity in our multiplicity, right? We're not saying it's all oatmeal. We're not saying it's all yogurt. I love yogurt. We're not saying it's all yogurt. We're saying in all of this particularity, that's how we see the multiplicity. We see God is everywhere because the psalmist has said the sea, the light, the dark, the womb, the earth, my limbs. It's important that we be able to articulate all the parts, because otherwise everywhere doesn't make sense. Think about that. Everywhere has no content unless there's particularity in everywhere. And so one of the reasons that I'm inviting you to become acquainted with your own parts is that it's hard for people to engage all the possibility that people, human beings, have. All the ability to create, all the ability to imagine, all the ability to have compassion, all the ability to create new knowledge, all the ability to love. If we can't engage our particular parts, our particularity, and the particularity of others. Multiplicity is not about saying, you're gonna have a ton of parts and they're just gonna fly everywhere, right? I'm not trying to disconnect you. I'm not trying to mystify you. I'm trying to say, you have pieces, parts, gifts, abilities, selves, roles that you barely, were barely conscious of. And if we could become more conscious of them, invite them to the conversation, there's so much more to human life. There's so much more to human life in God and in relation to God. But it takes some tuning of all of our parts. Yeah?
I didn't read your bio, this is my first session.
Hello, welcome.
You mentioned your students.
Yeah.
I'm going to guess they're in the millennial age.
I'm sorry, was I scaring you? But I was a preacher on a regular basis. My congregation would say, would you please go back behind that pulpit? So I apologize.
I just
want to
put my feet up.
No, it's fine. I entirely get it. I entirely get it. So are my students millennials, you're saying? And so are you saying, is this maybe something that they grasp more easily because of the generation they are?
Not necessarily. I'm just curious, but this group here is not the most diverse group. I think I can go out on a limb.
Well, it depends on which parts of you you're looking at.
Well, true.
Yeah.
As an aside, Thrivent is doing a series of seminars on generosity. And they've done pretty extensive research on different age groups. And generosity means something very different to each of those age groups. And if I can generalize, people sort of in our generation, we're the ones that tend to want to give more money, do a lot more volunteering. And I'm just curious if you had this same lecture discussion with your students and what kind of responses they may have had.
So my students are graduate students. End of students. I teach at Divinity School in Chicago. They range in age. One of my students was a 65-year-old attorney who retired from being the senior partner for the largest law firm in the country. And some of my students are just out of LBC. They're 20 to 23.
Like I said, I didn't really know.
Yeah. They're a whole range, and they're multiple faiths. So I have students who come from. Who are Muslim, my students are Buddhist, my students are Christian, of all varieties. When they hear this language, they are, first of all, relieved, because they've been taught their whole lives that they should be one thing, right? And they struggle with that. One of the reasons I developed some of this was really to kind of help ease their pain a little bit, because I saw their multiplicity as a gift, not as something to be overcome. Sadly, a lot of their churches, I'm not going to name any names because I'm in the arms of Luther here, some of their churches see this as a distraction or a detraction, and they want them to be more one. Be only interested in this. We only want to know, can you do X? And what they're doing is creating a pipeline of destruction, frankly. I mean, you and I can have this in different Bible. We can talk about that later. But I really think that not sharing with people, not training them to work out of their multiplicity, is asking them to play on one string of their guitar all the time. And you can play that one string, play that one string, play that one string, but what happens when people can't hear the one string, or when people don't like the one string, or when the one string's not the right thing, or when the one string breaks because that's all you did? I'm finding that for those students, they're not worried about this at all. They're just so relieved.
It just brings up some
Yes, absolutely. Absolutely. I agree. Thank you for noticing that. So what I want you to see when you look at Scripture is I'm not bringing you something that our faith forebears didn't know. We've forgotten it along the way, and the reason we've forgotten it has nothing to do with God, and it has nothing to do with Jesus, and it has nothing to do with the Spirit, and it has everything to do with the parts of the world that would want your faith to be less powerful. Ancients knew multiplicity. Mystics knew multiplicity. And if you think I'm asking you to spend a lot more time boring into yourself than people like to do, and that's just the psychotherapist part of me, that's not the psychotherapist part of me, that's the pastor part of me, and it's saying to you, in the spiritual practices of our Christian tradition, in the spiritual practice of the Muslim tradition, my Muslim students tell me we have five parts. They know what they are, and they know what the prayer practices are that will engage each one of the parts. My Buddhist students know all about parts. All of our spiritual traditions talk about the complexity and the multiplicity of the self, and many very developed spiritual practices, especially but not only, in the Catholic tradition over centuries, have been about the inner exploration. Some of you have practiced some of those Ignatian exercises or some of the more mystical traditions, and you know this to be true. It was understood from Augustine onward that the way to understand God is to understand yourself. Because if you are in the image of God, if you are created in the image of God, then part of your worship of God is reflecting, contemplating, beholding what God has created here, right? And that's complex, and it takes some time, and all of those things are things we don't have no clue. I invite you into a little deeper contemplation of selves this morning. Some of you will recognize maybe that one over there, right? That was from that funny little plane they stuck me in Wenatchee when I was flying to Wenatchee the other day. And this one actually comes from Indiana. So you can see a little bit of difference there. Just a reminder that what goes on inside you is a landscape, not a monolith. It's a landscape. In your landscape, there are maybe some peaks and some valleys. In your landscape, there are some flat places, some plains. In your landscape, there are colors and varieties. We're going to explore a little bit more today about what some of those are. But imagine what the globe would look like without that variety. Even when I fly over Utah, or when I fly over Oklahoma, even then, right, there's those circles, there's those crop circles, right? There is diversity and multiplicity and beauty in every inch of creation and in every inch in here as well. And so I like to ask people just to kind of contemplate, what's your inner landscape? Is it this? What's going on inside
Cynthia?
There? Yeah.
Boys? Oh, there. I hate to say this, but I think most of us are really Indiana because we're laid out in squares and we're meant to be laid out. Society puts us there.
Tell me more about what you mean by that. Thank you for saying that. Come on.
Well, I mean, it goes back to what you were saying where some religions want you to be one thing. And I think society wants us to be a certain way. So therefore, we're kind of laid out in a square saying, okay, this is your square. This is you. But I think we want to be the landscape of Chelan.
Hello, why do you come to this place?
Yeah.
Why do you come to this place?
Because it opens
you
up.
A little bit of it is you get permission from that, don't you?
Yeah.
Yeah. Think about that. I think that's true. Beautiful point. Thank you for bringing that up. I would say, I would qualify it only a bit to say you think you are this.
Yes.
Right? In actuality, I've never had a conversation with somebody that didn't go to a place where it was like, oh, you know, look at that. Mm-hmm. Look at that vast lake, or look at that peak. They're there. You're right to say that many of the exigencies of our modern life have such pressure on us, right, to be a certain way. Some of those things, we'll talk more about those on Friday, some of those things having to do with the culture that we live in, the economy that we live in, the way in which the political landscape that we live in wants to wield power in certain ways. But the fact is, while this is, and some of us just really are this, and are very pleased in our soul to be a quiet space, all of us have the potential for this as well. It's under there. Yeah.
Doesn't some of it also be where we're living?
And in which moment? And in which moment, right? I would say I started doing this research before immigration became a battle. I started doing this research before red states and blue states became a big divide. I started doing this research in some ways a little bit more peaceful or maybe more optimistic moment in our history. The need for seeing the possibility that's there has never been more important, I think, than it is right now. Yes.
I guess in teaching we look at students and that is orderly, it's sequential. And then you look at other people who, whether this is innate, but random, global, and so, and you tend to look at how to address both.
Right, exactly. I think teachers are great, teachers are doing this work all the time. I think you're trying to figure out, how does this mind work? We're now realizing they don't all work the same, right? And in a class of students, you're not doing things on the same sequence for everybody at the same time. You know this. I would say parents also know this. I have three children. They could have come from three different mothers for as much as they have in common, right? That we're not the same. And we're not the same because every instance that happens to us either carves out that little river or builds up that little mountain or creates more of a beach, everything that takes place, right? That's not a bad thing. It's not a good thing. It's an is thing. And we're best to kind of get on board and be curious about it and maybe excited and look at what it could do rather than the thing that happened a lot when I was a kid, which is to say, here's the line. Get on it. there's your spot. Whatever you have to carve out in order to fit into that line, you should fit into it, right? I think we all realize now that that wasn't necessarily a fullness of life, but how to do it instead is much more complicated. It's harder to run that classroom when you acknowledge that all the students aren't learning the same way at the same time, right? It's not easy. There's reasons why this works, right? There's reasons why the squares work, but they're not enough. They're not enough, I think, for this time. So, yeah, one more question that I want to
move. When you ask the question, which one of these would be you, the farm or the mountains, and immediately my mind went to one picture superimposed, because it isn't either this or that.
Yes.
It's this.
Yeah. Yep.
And that's what makes it so difficult, because if it could be just this and this, you could kind of manage it or control it better. But this is some kind of glorious search of where's the field and where's the river.
Exactly.
All the time.
Exactly. Yes. This model, multiplicity, is not a model about finding it and building the booth there. You know, when Jesus goes up the mountain with the guys and they say, well, can we stay here? Can we build little shelters? And can we just live in this peak moment? And Jesus says, no, there's people down there and you gotta go deal with them, right? Yes. This is not a static model at all. The model of multiplicity is valuable precisely because it's not. Because you can move from self to self, from voice to voice. I'm gonna tell you about that. I don't want you to think that what I'm asking you for is multiple personalities, right? There's all this language in the world about dissociative personalities. That's not what I'm asking you. But I do want you to be able to acknowledge some of the persons that you are inside and begin to think about how do you host that conversation, right? How do you host the conversation? So let me read to you two little bits from a book that's available in the bookstore, or maybe. If the bookstore is out of these and you really want one, this is from a study of pastors, actually. If you are a pastor, you might want this. If you know a pastor, you might want to gift it to them. I'd be happy to, if these are out in the bookstore, the publisher gives them to me a whole lot more cheaply than Amazon will sell them to you. I'd be happy to give them to you at my cost. If they're no longer in the bookstore, come find me. Give me your name and address. I'll see that you get one. It might take a bit, but I'd be happy to do that. But let me read to you a little bit about how multiplicity looks on the inside from one of the pastors I interviewed, and then just in my own head. It's so that you'll know that you do this too. My research was interviewing a lot of pastors to just tell me about their lives in ministry. The question was very broad. I wasn't looking for multiplicity. I had never even heard of the word when I started interviewing them. One pastor recounts a time when he recognized that there were more than one of him. He says, I was in a meeting talking about the Sunday school or something like that. Got a call from the church office telling me that Geraldine Allen's husband had been mowing the lawn and had collapsed. The ambulance took him to the hospital. He died when he got there. Meanwhile, Geraldine was still at home. The hospital called the church office to request that I go be with her, that I tell her that her husband had died. Afterwards, I thought about that. It wasn't really my job to do that. I don't do notification, but of course, I did it. That was years ago when I was still newer at the church. I was scared to death. What do I do? What do I say? So you just go and be there. There are all kinds of experiences in ministry that you get called into and you don't know what to do. You know you can't possibly do this, but you just go and be there anyway. You just do what the situation presents. I think it's not you so much as what you represent. At the same time, it is also who you are. You bring all of that too. Still, years later, you say to yourself, I can't believe I could do such a thing. That must have been somebody else. Maybe some of you recognize a situation like this in yourself, a time in which the thing you were called to do was not something you had the equipment, not something you had the equipment to do, not something you had the imagination to do, maybe not even something you wanted to do, right? And yet, you do, and you kind of stand back, a little part of you is kind of surprised, like, look what I can do. So there's those moments. There's also a moment that I think probably happens to us often. Again, I wrote this for pastors, so it's kind of got a pastor influence in it, but it's not necessary. Imagine that you're at work at your desk on a Saturday morning, deeply immersed in study. Perhaps you're preparing tomorrow's sermon, and you've just hit your stride working toward the sermon's climax, or maybe you finally articulated the point that will complete the term paper due next week. A gentle breeze from the open window plays with the papers on the corner of your desk, and your eyes are drawn from your computer screen to the scene outside. It's a beautiful spring day, beautiful summer day at Holden, one of the warmer in a long time. Your dog stirs from his place on the rug beside your desk and looks hopeful. His tail is drumming the floor. He is begging for a walk outside, and some part of you, restless from winter's captivity indoors, is eager to leave your desk, indulge the dog, and pay appropriate attention to the glorious day. You ask yourself if you've made enough progress to take a well-deserved break, or if you're simply avoiding a challenging assignment for a little bit longer. Another voice inside your head urges you not to take yourself more seriously than you ought to. A lovely spring morning is too rare to ignore. But before you can adjudicate between the writer and the nature lover, you suddenly remember you promised yourself to address the clog in the kitchen sink before the morning was over. And so a third voice enters the conversation, the voice of the manager. How can you even think about enjoying a walk while you have water standing in your sink? The writer becomes a bit tendentious now. What's more important, the kitchen sink or a powerful sermon? And the nature lover, not to be outdone, shakes her head and refuses to believe that such temporal concerns could overshadow the fleeting beauty of an April morning. Does this sound familiar?
Yes.
All of you, okay. So I don't have to say anything else about whether or not you're multiple. This is a thing. You know it. There are the voices. I want to spend a little time today letting you go deeper. For those of you who were here yesterday, we did a little exercise where you got to name some I ams, right? I am I. We had some people with 50 I ams and some people with 5 I ams. How many does not make any difference? What makes a difference is you know that you're fluid. You know that you're multiple. You know you can move. So I want to spend... photo isn't a very good one. That's my black cat. He's watching a black cat on television. It is to say curiosity, right? Curiosity about who we are, what's out there and what's in here. That's from birth. We're all born without the ability to discriminate between me and mom, right? For a while, mamas know this, dads too. For a while, there is no out there for a child, right? An infant experiences everything in the world as part of me, right? And part of the job of becoming sort of fully sentient being is realizing, oh, there's a space. I stop here. Somebody else starts there. In that creation of space, selves are already being formed. They start that young. Little fragments of, I get reinforcement for this. Oh, she wants me to be that. Oh, this feels good. Oh, this does not. Those things start really early. So you've been accreting selves for a really long time. There is my favorite psychotherapist or psychoanalyst, Winnicott, talks about the fact that this process of differentiating me from you creates a space that for the longest time in a child, and even for a lot of adults, there's a little bit of space in us that is not quite me and not quite you. He calls it the transitional space, or the third place, meaning not me, not you, but third. He says that space, which is, you can't look at your brain and find it. He's hypothesizing this, right? He's making a geography, a landscape for us. But he leaves in his landscape a little space. And this little space, he says, is where art comes from. It's where creativity comes from. And he says it's where spirituality comes from. I would call that space sort of the imagination. That's where the fluidity is. That's where the movement is. And so when I'm working with these pastors, or when we're working with one another, one of the things we're thinking about is, where's that space, right? The space between the cat and screen. Where's that space in which we can play a bit, we can open a bit, we can let ourselves emerge, and we can get to know them a bit. Ways that you can get to know yourselves. The I Am exercise we did yesterday. Storytelling is a way that a lot of people come to identify themselves. You can give folks a prompt. Think about a time when you did X. Tell me a story about that. And in the storytelling, a certain kind of person will emerge. If you ask for a different story about a different time, when something different happens, you're going to get a little bit different narrator, right? A little bit different person is going to emerge. Personality mapping. There's a book by Rita Carter called Multiplicity. I didn't find this till after I'd already published mine, but if people are interested in this topic of how do you engage the different parts of yourself and what can you come to know about them, she's a British psychotherapist, and she has she's done a lot of work in this, and including like half the book is full of exercises about how you would do this. I'm going to share a page from that book with you in just a minute. She talks about finding a couple of those selves that we maybe some of the things that you spoke out loud yesterday during the I Am exercise. What are 3 to 5 roles or selves or attributes? 3 or 5 of yourselves, pick those out, and then spend a little time with each one. It's okay even to give them a name. This could be your, mine in here were the nature lover, the manager, the writer. I can list up a bunch more of those. Give that self a name or a description, and then see what you can find out about each one of those. This is important because I'm not just asking you to split up your roles, right? That's not helpful on its own, but to see what they'll do for you. So let me suggest this. And then we'll talk a little bit about those functions of these. Let's take a minute. I'm going to ask you, Yesterday we took minutes and spent with each other. I'm going to ask you to just spend a minute with yourselves today. Think about maybe the most prominent parts of you, right? The parts of you that come to say, if you were to do the I am exercise in your mind today, which could be different than yesterday, what are the first three, we'll just do three today, what are the first three roles that come up for you? I'm a boom. Then take a page out of Rita's book. And she says, once you discover those three, once you identify them, spend a minute. See how those three feel. And see how the other selves, the new, feel about that one, right? So how do they feel? How do other selves feel about that? And then she has a whole list of attributes, things like creative, questioning, talkative, energetic, even-tempered, disorganized, moody, jealous, envious, shy. There's a long list of attributes. But if you would take just one, because you won't have any more time than that, pick one of those selves that you've identified and just play a little bit with getting to know that one, using some of the attributes on her sheet. Is that clear? So all you're doing is trying to get a little closer to one of those many parts of you. Because it's not enough to have parts, right? You need to know the parts a little bit, right? To understand what they can do for you or what they're not doing for you. That's also a thing, right? Or what they're doing for and to you that necessarily isn't helpful. So does that make sense? I don't know if I have enough sheets. You may need to share and I can make more later on. I'll start one over here. We're just gonna take about 10 minutes. So that you have this exercise by jotting down IMA. Now that you have the sheets in front of you somehow, you can see that there's two parts to the sheet, right? One is a rating thing. Don't pay attention to the rating thing. Look at the part of the sheet that has all those lists of attributes on it. All that you're going to do for today, if you want to go very deeply into this, you can get Rita's book and she'll show you how. I don't need you to do all that today. I just want to get you a taste. What I want you to do is pick out one of your roles, one of your I ams, and then use that list of attributes to start describing yourself in that role. When you're in that role, which of these attributes apply to it and which don't?
There's only one problem.
Yeah.
If you pick up, let's say, conscientious.
Yeah.
Because that's what I am, okay?
Yeah.
I look down at careless and there's a few things there.
Yeah.
That fall into the same category.
Yes. That's the point. This is exactly why that big long list of attributes is there. Because we tend to think of a role as just one thing. A role isn't just one thing. Many things go on there, right?
Yeah.
Yep. That's the point.
I know.
There is no wrong way to do this. Exploration. You can do, and just how much there is to do. Right? We're good at occupying those squares. We've done it a long time. It really takes a while. If all you did during that quiet time was like your mind was all skittery and you were going around trying to figure out like which one of your roles you wanted to deal with. Because we are so good at adapting to what is being asked of us. And what's being asked of us mostly is to be not complicated. Right? Your yourself three of your roles or three of your attributes. Again, notice I'm using this language in a very slippery way. Sometimes I call them roles, sometimes I call them personalities. No spot. They're pretty fluid. I don't wanna the fact that we experience ourselves also as unity means I don't want to separate out yourselves. But I want you to find the little space where you can say, oh, there's a lot of me that in these situations acts like this. That manager in me, it has these attributes. It's not very generous. It's really quarrelsome. However, it gets a lot of stuff done, right? It gets a lot of stuff done. It's good to know both. In your day-to-day life, I'm guessing yourself. You spend a lot of time saying, why the heck didn't I do X? A lot of wasted time, effort, energy, space. Telling yourself you should have done it differently. Do, and an ability to say to that self, you know what, that was a good enough thing. It wasn't a perfect thing, it was a good enough thing. Because I've got another self over here, I call it the wise friend. The wise friend, she says, hey, you know what, that was good enough, let it go. Right? That was good enough, let it go. It did some things. And by the way, you may want to thank the manager because the manager does stuff nobody else wants to do. Good thing. All right. So living with that kind of generosity and grace that you extend to yourself gives you more energy, it gives you more flexibility, it gives you more adaptability. When you're in a situation where there's conflict, how many of you live in maybe a workspace or a home space or a life space where there's conflict? Anybody? Oh. I'm the only one, right? Right? And what do we come to think about conflict? What do we feel about conflict? Avoid it, right? Avoid it. Some of us avoid it. What else?
Failure.
Risky.
But it's risky. It absolutely is risky. A lot
the
of us.
Work is not.
Pardon?
The work is not.
Thank you. Right. The flip side of conflict is, man, conflict is energy. If you can kind of, if you reframe conflict as energy, here and cheer if they want to, or say, you know what, you're going to be okay, or even tag team sometimes, right? Somebody's in conflict for a while, and then that self gets kind of burned out, and you put another one in, right? Such that conflict isn't self-destroying. Why do we avoid conflict? The fact is, conflict doesn't have to involve all of you. Conflict can involve a piece of you. Does that make sense? Yeah.
Now, have you ever had two people do it that know each other well, and you do your own kind of thing, and
yes,
the other person,
yes,
is doing you as well?
Yes. Yes.
And you find that what you wrote down, and I scribbled things, mm-hmm, would be different than what they saw.
Yes.
Or,
yes.
I was thinking, my husband is this. My husband.
Yep. Right.
It'd be interesting to see how what you think you are really,
yes,
really interrogating yourself and see what you are and then what people generally see you as.
Absolutely. Absolutely. If we had time and space, if we could spend a whole week on trying to put these pieces into bite-sized parts for 5 days and an hour when people are coming and going, that's a challenge. If we had all day today to do this one exercise, that's what you would do. You would do the I ams, and then you would do the I ams with a friend. And then you would do the attributes for the I ams, and then you would do the attributes with a friend, right? And then after that, you would do a different thing, which is to talk about the functions. Think about the functions that each of these selves that you have. What functions do they serve? Because usually, they're like groups. People who work with this stuff like to say one of those functions is a... Which one of your roles comes immediately to the surface? Is it the guardian, this one? Is it the worrier that thinks about what if, what if, what if? Is it the one that says, oh, here's a situation in which there's some conflict or risk, I need to please that person? And therefore, kind of, my mother's line was peace at any price. Did anybody else have my mother? Lots of different ways that our roles can help us control situations. Role players, the ones that come out, for example, in different social contexts when we think we need to be the person who's successful or we think we need to be the professional. Children, especially second or third children, take on the family role as the lightener, the cut-up, the clown, the humor person, and they take that well into adulthood with them, right? There's always a guy at the board meeting or a woman at the board meeting who, when things get tense, you know, manages to crack a joke about something that's happening in the ceiling. I don't know. Those things happen. So those are different kinds of functions that yourselves can play. And of course, the creatives, let's not forget. There are artists and dreamers and conversation. How do you get your parts to start talking to each other? How do you get that tag team thing to happen? The same way you do any other kind of conversation. Honestly, this isn't mysterious or rocket science. You need a quiet place. You need time, right? The thing that gets in the way most of us knowing ourselves and deploying them is that we're in a hurry. We're going from thing to thing to thing to thing, and we react, right? We don't respond. Respond means it takes some time at the beginning of the day. You do your devotion, you do your meditation, you do your breathing, you do your body work, and then you spend a minute in conversation with yourselves. Sorting yourselves out for the day. What's coming up? Which one of me is going to be there? Which one of us is going to work at this? This is taken from Rita's book, sort of a simple, straightforward procedure for how to host that conversation. You don't have to do that every day. You don't even have to do that every week. Every now and then, if you start the process of hosting the conversation between the parts of yourselves, when you need it, you'll be able to get there more quickly. You know what I'm saying? Does that make sense? And then in general, how is it that you even keep the room clean for the conversation, right? How do you keep the space in yourself for that conversation to happen? Multiplicity alive. They cultivated, they had close friends, and close friends who weren't a part of their workspace. They lived spiritual community and spiritual practice, including body practices that they weren't leading, by the way. They did some spiritual community outside of their own professional life. They were involved, like you all are, in lifelong learning. I feel like I'm preaching to the choir because this sounds like Holden Village, right? Lifelong books, writing was big with these folks. Relationships with, I'm going to use a word that's freighted in the political landscape right now, but relationships with the other. Whether the other is the natural world like you've come up here to be a part of where things are weird and strange and not like you, or whether that's travel where you're just immersing yourself in Why am I Muslim? No. Do I need to understand that God is bigger than mine? Yes, I do. So lots of ways that you can connect with the world. Storytelling. I mean, this culture is a storytelling culture. All of my students, all of that kind of storytelling going on in very secular, quote-unquote, if there is such a thing, spaces. Why is that happening? I think that's happening because the world that we live in is so, it takes so much of us to deal with We'll start here tomorrow, but just so that you know, there's a reason to be doing this. And I've mentioned this, I think, hopefully, each of the days that we've been talking together. Of our essence as humans, to develop this multiplicity. Many of your grandparents maybe lived in the same space, the same town, the same home maybe even, doing the same thing, and maybe the same thing that the generation had done before them. They probably didn't have the internet. They probably, some of them didn't have television. Some of them didn't have television. If you think about what that life was like, how quick it was or wasn't, how much came in or didn't come in, you realize that how you live now is very, very, very different than that, right? You're dealing with incoming input all the time. Multiplicity is necessary to develop because it helps you sort, it helps you think, it helps you respond in ways that are generous and compassionate and courageous and creative and peaceful. I'll close with, I'll let Bonhoeffer close, right? He writes to me and he says, Professor Linden, he discovered it, but it's an interesting, one gradually learns to acquire an inner detachment from life's menaces. He's writing this, right, when he is in prison. Although acquired detachment seems too negative, formal, artificial, and stoical, and perhaps it's more accurate to say we assimilate these menaces into our life as a whole. I notice repeatedly here, he's talking from his incarceration, how few people there are who can harbor conflicting emotions at the same time. When waters come, they're all fear. When there's something nice to eat, they're all greed. When they're disappointed, they're all despair. When they're successful, they can think of nothing else. They miss the fullness of life and the wholeness of an independent existence. Everything objective and subjective is dissolved for them into fragments. By contrast, Christianity puts us into many dimensions of life at the same time. We make room in ourselves to some extent for God and the whole world. We rejoice with those who rejoice and weep with those who weep. We are anxious about our life, but at the same time, we must think about things much more important to us than life itself. When the alert goes off, for instance, as soon as we turn our minds from worrying about our own safety to the task of helping other people keep calm, the situation is completely changed. Life isn't pushed back into a single dimension, but is kept multidimensional and polyphonous. I love that word, polyphonous, many-voiced. What a deliverance it is to be able to think and thereby remain multidimensional. I've almost made it a rule here simply to tell people who are trembling under an air raid that it would be much worse for a small town. We have to get people out of their one-track minds. That is a kind of preparation for faith or something that makes faith possible, although really it's only faith itself that can make possible a multi-dimensional life. So I'll leave you with that. I hope you'll come back tomorrow to think about those. Tell me.